with information on the latest developments in assistive technology and initiatives from the studios of 2RPH in Sydney. RPH Australia brings you AbleQuest. Hello, I'm Marnie Roper. At the recent Live Work Play conference in Sydney, Dr. Karen Wolf, a career counsellor from Austin, Texas, was a keynote speaker. Dr. Wolf is a specialist working with people who are blind or partially sighted to explore and decide job search options. She consults worldwide on employability skills training and transition programming for people with disabilities. Barbara Sullivan managed to interview Dr. Wolf between conference sessions to follow up on the main points in her presentation.
You talked about learned helplessness, which I felt was almost a general societal trend with parents, as families have got smaller, I suppose, and there's only one or two children, and parents focus so much attention on them. Do you think that is true in general?
I see it rampant in our society. I don't think it's just people with disabilities or just families with disabilities or just special education. I think that the literature on learned helplessness actually comes out of the general public, and I think it's exactly what you're saying. We've had a whole generation of parents who have felt like they needed to do more and more and more and more for their children, and they've put less and less responsibility on those kids. And as a consequence, the children haven't had the opportunity to learn to do for themselves. And it is, I think, pervasive.
Yes, so if it's true in general, then it's even more true, presumably.
It is more poignant, I think, in families with disabled children, because I think there's the overlay of families sometimes really feeling that they are obligated to do more for these children because they have suffered in some way an assault to their ability to perform. And parents sometimes feel guilty about the child not being, quote unquote, the child they were expecting. And I think that leads to a tendency that people have to overprotect and overdo. And certainly for people who are blind or visually impaired, we see that in the field a great deal. We're not just parents either. It's parents, teachers, the general public will run to pick up something that somebody drops without even giving them an opportunity, or will jump in and do something for a person that they may not have even wanted done. I had a friend one time who was dragged across the street, but she didn't want to cross.
She
didn't.
She was just standing there.
She was actually waiting for me. And she had to come back across to catch me. It just happens.
And it's done with the best of intentions.
Exactly.
So there's a lot of education that needs to happen. Mm-hmm. How do you think that that can happen in broader society?
Well, I think part of it is teaching young people with disabilities to be able to say, no, thank you. No, thank you. I don't need that help.
Yes.
I'm able to do this. And I think that we've been hesitant about doing that, thinking that it's kind of nice that they have this extra help. But it's not kind of nice. It's really detrimental to them because it robs them of that opportunity to practice and learn skills that they're going to need as adults. And then in terms of society, I think just like I have been talking about promoting the idea that people with disabilities can do, and that we promote people who are doing, that we give indicators to the public that these things are happening, that the more we do that, the better, and that we also need to let people in the general public know that they should perhaps offer to assist, but should not assume that they need to assist.
Would you like some help? Not let me help you.
Exactly. Exactly. May I help you? Do you need some assistance? Rather than making the assumption that the person must have assistance.
I think Australia is a caring country, and they're generally, there's a level of civility and politeness. So if they saw somebody in a position that they thought they were needing help, they'd feel that they should do that.
And I don't want to discourage that. I don't want people to not care. I want people to care. I want people to reach out to help other people. I just don't want them to do things for people that they can do for themselves.
You touched a little on infrastructure and environmental barriers, mm-hmm. and the legislation that's come up around that in terms of accessibility and restaurants and mm-hmm. so on. Access and inclusion are in an odd way almost diametrically opposed.
It's so true. There was a wonderful book called The Death of Common Sense. And in that book, they talk about New York City, and there was a piece of legislation passed where New York City was required to make available wheelchair-accessible public toilets. And they were fabulously expensive. They took up a lot of room on the street. New York doesn't have a lot of room on its sidewalks, and they took up an entire section of the sidewalk. But they were forced legislatively to do that, and no one ever used them. They spent thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars, and no one ever used them. And I read that in the book, and I thought, this is part of what's wrong with the idea about people making decisions for other people who don't really understand what the needs are and how best to address those needs. What New York City needed to do in that instance was meet with people who used certain routes and find out from them, was there a need for such a thing as an accessible toilet in that particular area? Would people use it, and would they want it to be there? Because if no one wants it and no one needs it, why put it there?
Yes.
You shouldn't make decisions for people because you think that makes the world a better place. And I think you make a really good point. Accessibility and inclusion are not synonymous. Inclusion is about being able to do things with other people that you choose to do and that they choose to have you engaged in with them. It's reciprocal. We don't talk about inclusion and it's one person sitting in the middle of the room all by themselves and call that an inclusive environment. That's isolation.
Yes.
And so I think we have to be very careful. We sometimes see legislators, we sometimes see educators, we sometimes see designers make decisions in the absence of input from the people who will be affected or impacted.
Yes.
Day late and a dollar short,
yeah.
isn't it? You ask before you build it, not when it's built. And I think that's the key, isn't it? To make something accessible opens up the opportunity for inclusion, but only if it truly is accessible. And then you can be included.
Talking about that in relation to the workplace, mm-hmm. let's suppose an employer wants to employ somebody with disabilities. They've selected them as being the best person for that job. And let's assume that they have never before made any attempt to make their workplace particularly accessible because they've never really needed to. How should they go about that process? What's your advice on that?
My advice is based on what I have seen work most effectively in the United States. So I don't know if it's going to be transferable into Australian business or not, but the way that it works at home is that because of our ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, there is the caveat within that legislation that employers must make accommodations available to qualified applicants who are chosen for particular jobs. And so when I work with individuals, I always encourage them to talk about what they're going to need and how that will enable them to do the job efficiently and effectively and competitively so that that employer is not caught off guard. I think, it's my own personal opinion, that it is an important way to convey to other people that you are comfortable with your disability, that you accept what your abilities are and how you're going to do things differently than someone who, for in this instance, would have full sight. I think it makes the employer feel more comfortable and it sets the stage. I think people with disabilities themselves are the ones who know best what they need in order to get the job accomplished. But to be able to express that to the employer, they have to know what the job entails so that they can match it up.
So it should be part of the interview process.
I can't imagine a reasonable employer offering a job to someone if he didn't know or she didn't know how they would be able to manage in the environment. So I think it could easily keep someone from getting a job.
I was going to say it could be a barrier to selection.
I think it would be. I would never hire somebody that I couldn't envision how they would be able to do the job. What are qualifications? Qualifications are indicators that you have certain competencies. If one of those competencies is something that the employer anticipates requires vision, and you can't articulate how you're going to get that accomplished, I don't see the employer believing that you have the competency to do that job. And I would question the placement. It would be like me going to apply for a job as a jackhammer operator.
Yes.
I might be able to say that I can do it, and I might be able to talk about knowing how to do it, and I might be able to even convey to an employer that I was skilled enough to do that. But the truth of the matter is I could not handle that piece of equipment. It's too big for me. It would vibrate too much for me. It would shake me. I would never survive that job. And so I would need to talk about, if I really wanted a job like that, how I was going to be able to do that with my physical limitations as they are.
So this is in your program, part of the building self-awareness.
Exactly. I think people have to know what they can do and what they can't do.
And again, part of it is identifying their capabilities
right. And
remediating any deficiencies.
Exactly. And making sure that you've done the research that you need to do before you go for a job interview, that you can in fact do that job.
Which is true of anyone.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not about blindness or visual impairment. Mm. And it's not about saying that you can do something if you can't. So I always encourage people to talk in the interview about who they are and how they approach tasks and how they are able to do things differently in some instances than that employer may be expecting. The employer is expecting a fully sighted person, so if you're blind, you need to explain to him or her how you're going to do that job, or all their misperceptions and misconceptions about how it could be or should be or would be done are going to come to bear.
How do you feel Australia's faring in terms of your approach to this? Other people in Australia taking the approach that you are with your programs?
You know, I'm very happy to say that I see a lot of progress being made. I've been coming over to Australia now since, I think, maybe 2006-ish. And I've had the opportunity to work with some brilliant teachers, some great parents, some very, very proactive adults with blindness and visual impairment. Some of the organizations have picked up the materials. Vision Australia is using the PEP program to deliver trainings in employability skills. I just see a lot of progress, and I'm very happy about it, and I'm also very, very pleased to see that people are so appreciative of the work. And I think we're going to see really good results. Vision Australia is getting ready to do a big project, an 18-month project under government funding, as I understand it, and they'll use those materials and we'll evaluate how people are performing coming onto the program and how they are performing coming off the program and how many move into full-time employment and so on and so forth. And that's going to give us a nice little piece of research to verify whether or not it's as effective as we think it is.
And some success stories may come out of it.
Oh, they will. I'm absolutely convinced they will.
Well, thank you very much, Karen.
My pleasure.
You have just been listening to AbleQuest, a program that looks at developments in assistive technology. From Barbara Sullivan and Marnie Roper, thank you for listening and goodbye till next program.